Yeah, that's where they had.
This is recorded on the morning of July 17th, 1972, an interview between President Emeritus Frederick L. Hubby and R.B. Eccles, Department of History, in the Executive Building of Purdue University. This interview is for the Purdue University Archives. Well, President Hubby, we were talking last time about legislature and relations with the state. Let's start out this morning with problems that a president encounters with his faculty.
Well, obviously, in colleges and universities, the function of the president and the Board of Trustees is to do everything within their power to enable the so-called faculty, or the teachers of the institution, to do their jobs most effectively. If you assume that the sole purpose of the institution is, of course, to teach and to do research and to preserve knowledge and to discover new knowledge, then those things that contribute to the search and the work towards those objectives is, of course, the work of the management and administration. For my part, my relationships with the faculty as a whole, the faculties of the divisions of the university, and with faculty members as individuals, has always been very cordial and very happy. In general, I personally have always had great admiration for the first-class teacher, the scholar, the scientist, the creative mind, and wherever it existed in the university, I always liked to do whatever I could to help that individual or group of individuals. Faculty organization within the university structure is, of course, another topic, because under the charter and bylaws of the university, certain powers are delegated to the faculty as an organized group within the structure or membership of the university. In general, most universities, faculties are given certain specific powers, which they must then exercise through their own form of faculty government.
You're referring to such things as the organization of the Senate, faculty Senate.
I'm referring to the governance of the university. Since certain powers are designated to the faculty, and the faculty organization has to be so established and managed as to carry out those duties and responsibilities. One of the duties, of course, is to fix the calendar. This is a simple matter, but yet very, very complicated, because the calendar of the university essentially determines when the institution is in session or in being or is actively doing its work with all its faculty and students present. And of course, we have seen the changes in the university calendars over the past 25 years. Indeed, Purdue University goes to a new calendar this coming month, August, for the term beginning in the fall of 1972. The second power of the faculty, of course, is to determine the requirements for the degrees in terms of academic courses that the applicant must take and the quality level that the faculties prescribe for the various schools and divisions of the university. Power is not given to the faculty. Of course, they're vested in the president of the university. The principal powers that are vested in the president of the university are few and simple. Two, essentially. One, they have the power of the president is given the power of appointment to the staff. Now, of course, the power of appointment determines who you choose to man your university. Power of appointment is a very, very important thing in the management of any given university. Now, of course, the president doesn't appoint everybody. The arms of the president are the sub-administrative officers, which are the vice presidents, and then the deans, and then the department heads. And in that last analysis, it's the department head who is the administrative officer who is most important in the choice of personnel. And where you find strong department heads, capable department heads, who serve a department for a given length of time, you generally find a strong department. Second power given to the president, of course, is the power to allocate the university resources among its functions and divisions. The university resources, of course, essentially go back to money. Operating money, the annual operating cost of the university, and of course the money used then to provide facilities. That means buildings and what goes in buildings. That means equipment of all types and kinds, including books and a library, and all the other things that are required to perform the teaching function, and the research function, and the public service function in a modern multi-university, as Chancellor Clark Carr called it. I made it a cardinal practice of mine never to interfere with the functions that belong to the faculty. Conversely, I always made it crystal clear that until the trustees changed the rules and regulations, I would allow no interference with my duties and responsibilities as president, powers, the exercise of the powers given to the president. Under Purdue University organization, of course, the president is also chairman of the faculty. And as such, chaired, when I came, the faculty meetings, which at that time were faculty meetings of the whole. Every voting member of the faculty was privileged to attend the faculty meetings and participate. And as head of the faculty, the president chaired those meetings. And when you had meetings that were considering important business, with as many as 400 faculty members present, the task of managing the faculty became like a meeting of Congress. It was a parliamentary procedure which took time and could become very difficult to manage. On the other hand, we never had very many cases where faculties were split so badly as to cause an impasse, to strain tempers.
I've heard, and I'd like to have you talk on this, because there was a rumor that you believed that there was a very definite point that beyond which the faculty could not go, that you tried to keep the control in latter years, not of the faculty directly and not through the Senate. And this may be a rumor and a criticism, but I'd like to have you talk to it.
But I don't understand what you said.
Well, simply that you kept the Senate from being too active when your control went directly to the deans. And the Senate was, in a somehow or other, that you didn't care to have the Senate operate as it was operating when you retired?
No, the tasks that faced the president and so on became so demanding and so on, and then we went through a whole series of reorganizations. At least three are reorganizations of the faculty during my tenure, and the eventual end up of the faculty organization was the creation of the Faculty Senate to act for the faculty as a whole. And of course, in the administrative organization of the university, we had the Vice President for Academic Affairs. And it was, while I was the President of the Senate, President of the faculty, I designated the Vice President for Academic Affairs to act for me as Chairman of the Senate. And that was I occasionally attended Senate meetings, and I attended as an observer, although I had the power to speak. On the other hand, we also had the faculties of the schools of the universities under the deans. And they met and considered affairs, academic affairs, pertinent to their separate schools, the separate schools, professional schools of the university. Well, obviously, the president couldn't attend all the faculty meetings of the schools and so on. And so instead of my sitting at the head and chairmaning the Senate meetings, the Vice President for Academic Affairs was my alter ego. And he was the ideal spot for him because the Vice President for Academic Affairs was exactly that in my administration. And the faculty's concerns were primarily academic affairs. But I think it was better if the president were not involved in the academic debates in the Senate. They were freer, say what they think. Of course, actually, the work of a faculty is all done by committees. And for every conceivable problem, the first action of any faculty senate is to appoint a committee.
Unfortunately.
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, we have no other technique.
Who is it that says that a giraffe is the only animal in the world that looks as if it were put together by a committee?
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Well, you can say what you like about committees, but it's the only technique that is really available, unless you want to take a problem and vested solution of the problem in a one-man committee. Committees take time. Committees generally are appointed or elected by the Senate and consist of individuals with varying viewpoints with respect to any given problem. And out of many committees came minority reports as well as majority reports. And one of the difficult part of committee rule, of course, committee determination of policy and committee solving of problems is the time. It was interminably. And many, many times, of course, faculty committees will absolutely fail to face up to problems. Some problems they will not face up to. One great realm of difficulty in modern years on the part of faculties is facing up to the whole problem of the administration of student discipline. Just like the students themselves, you see. One thing about faculty students, faculty government is that each successive form that our faculty government here took in my tenure was adopted upon the recommendations of a faculty committee. It was their own creation. And somehow or other, faculty, many people on the faculty, some do not, I would look on the president as an antagonist of some kind. And as I started out this particular morning's record, I said the function of the president was to make it possible for the faculty to do their work most effectively. Presumably that's what the faculty want, all the proper conditions to do their work. If they just want a sinecure and don't want to do anything, then I'm not interested. But each form of faculty organization was created by a blue ribbon committee of our leading people. The election of senators to the faculty is a very, very important function of the faculties. And like most elections, people don't take much interest in the elections until crisis comes along.
And then they do become interested.
And then they do become
interested. And of course you have the nature of faculties, like someone has said about Germans, you have two Germans, you have four political opinions.
Well.
And of course that's what you expect from the nature of a teacher. You're going to have a lot of opinions and sometimes contradictory opinions on the same subject. But on the whole...
The major issue as far as faculty are concerned in our universities over the years has been academic freedom, really. And when it comes to academic freedom, the great fighters for academic freedom have been the presidents, not the faculty themselves.
Well, is that because of the nature of the organization or because presidents are more alive to it?
Well, I don't know as the aliveness or awareness of it is there. The presidents certainly are the ones that who are put on the pan and on the public pan with respect to any issue of academic freedom. They're put on the pan by every conceivable kind of group. Parents, alumni, citizen groups of all kinds, legislature.
Pressure groups. Such
pressure groups.
What's been the worst pressure group? Not the worst, but the most strongest pressure group that you encountered in the state?
Well, the one great issue that I fought behind the scenes and never reached the public press was with the American Legion. We had invited Linus Pauling to dedicate the Wetherill Chemistry Lab when it was built. The American Legion, which is headquartered in Indianapolis, objected. I made a number of trips down there to meet with the American Legion officials and people. And they wanted me to withdraw the invitation to Pauling, who was then receiving lots of publicity as a fellow traveler or communist, whatever you want to call them. Those people, the ultra-liberals in those days. I said to the group, there are undoubtedly lots of people that you don't want to allow to speak on university campuses. You'll give me a list of those names of people you prescribe, I then would be in a position to do something about seeing who's invited and who isn't. But of course they wouldn't. I said if they had to give me a list, it had to be made public. Everybody had to be told who the American Legion would not allow to speak anywhere.
In a state institution?
Well, any place. And particularly in a state institution. And eventually, they did nothing about it, and I invited them to come up and hear Linus Pauling's speech, and I was president of his speech that day in the chemistry lab, and it was a very, very fine presentation in the field of chemistry. It had nothing to do with politics or social problems or international relations or anything else.
I mean, it was appropriate for the occasion.
Pauling later became a Nobel Prize winner, and was at that time a distinguished chemist, and still is for that matter. And funny thing, American Legion people didn't know that Linus Pauling had done some very, very important and interesting war work. I happen to know about that because I knew him during the war. And I knew him at Caltech. Funny thing about war, I've known a great many high-ranking officers of the Army, Navy, and Air Force in my time in life, worked with a great many of them. The real top fighters are as much anti-war as any pacifist I've ever met, even though it's their duty and task to protect the United States.
They have perhaps a greater familiarity with war than pacifists.
Well, they're greater students of this particular preoccupation of the human race, namely fighting in one form or another. But they, as I said once before, the atomic bomb ought to be given the Nobel Peace Prize, but to be so strong that no one dare attack you is one of the greatest guarantee of peace there is.
That's right.
Little Israel sits there in the middle of a lot of enemies who don't dare attack her because they'd likely be defeated again.
They've had it three times. They've been defeated three times.
Essentially. So you sit there in a state of uneasy peace, but it's still peace.
Still peace.
Although it's psychological warfare and economic warfare and social warfare. It's a state of warfare of using different kinds of weapons. Economic weapons, and social weapons, and propaganda weapons, psychological weapons. So on.
You know, I thought a group that would have been some group like the State Teachers Association or something like the Parent Teachers Association would have brought pressure for curriculum changes and some that kind of thing.
No. You see, the curriculum in a university is not of... It's more professional in its nature, and any group that was going to bring a pressure for curricular changes is done in a different way in the professional societies. The professional societies generally appoint committees and issue reports from time to time about the status of the education for the profession. See, in engineering there have been reports that go way back to the early Wickenden Commission, and there have been three or four major national engineering reports.
In 17 altogether, according to Dean Potter.
Well, there probably have been 17 important national committees on engineering. And the same could be said for almost every other profession. President Elliott, my predecessor, when he retired, chairman of the Pharmaceutical Survey, and examined the status of pharmacy in this country and made a whole series of recommendations.
But those didn't affect you directly, though.
Well, they affected us directly in terms of what we then had to do if major changes were made in any of the professional school curricula.
But this wasn't...
But we were part and parcel of all those studies.
Sure. It was not outside pressure, such as the Legion.
Well, it was the outside... Well, it was the self-examination of the professionals involved. And to this... We were always a party. Indeed, sometimes we were stimulators of this kind of study. And this is the kind of analytical study that makes the stuff for of progress, makes the stuff for progress.
Did you ever get any pressure in the sense of changing the nature of the agricultural school, or from out from the state offices, or from outside the state?
No. No. You see, in the main, Purdue had been given some quasi-governmental functions that affect most directly affect the relationships of the university with the farmers of the state. The state chemist was located here, was possessed specified functions as a state officer. The administration of the fertilizer quality and standards given to the state chemist. And in those cases where violations of the state regulations occurred, and suit had to be brought against sellers and users of purveyors of substandard fertilizers that were cheating the farmer and so on, you generally got resistance, anger, part of people. But those questions were always adjudicated, finally, in courts of law, which the university, through the people of the state chemist's office, were directly involved on one side and the protagonist on the other. But our administration of all these laws in the state over the years, as it was divorced from politics, was superb. Never any problem and never any real difficulties. The administration was superb, and that's why there never was any strong and marked demand in the legislature to create a Department of Agriculture. The Lieutenant Governor, you see, among other things, is the Commissioner of Agriculture. Well, the Lieutenant Governor has no agricultural staff or organization. He relies on the experiment station at Purdue University and the state chemist. But when it comes to this whole line of quasi-governmental function, really governmental function assigned to the university, when it happened by law, we gave it first-class administration and management, independent of party politics and the spoiled system and all this kind of thing. But as a university policy, from time to time through the years, proposals were put up in the legislature to involve the university in the management of some state function. And we always opposed this. We didn't want to become responsible for the administration of state laws and regulations outside, all are related to education, but we didn't want the task of being involved in the management of a political aspect of state function.
In other words, you didn't want to become a football.
Well, we didn't want those things because they all meant trouble and difficulties for the university. We had some of them, and those we did have from early times, we administered so well, really, that there was never any kickback. But whenever people would approach us and ask the university to take over the manager of some aspect of state activity, we always said no, and we didn't want to become involved. We wanted to be left free to do our teaching and our research and so on. The State Highway Commission, of course, responsible for the development of roads and all this sort of thing, traffic problems in the state. Its research arm was vested in School of Civil Engineering with the formation of the Joint Highway Research Program. This goes back to the 30s, and this was the first of its kind. Well, the School of Civil Engineering then became involved in research problems, all the gamut of research problems related to highways. And many times, the results of research, when published and so on, would affect some element, affect some companies that were making materials or building roads or something or other. And we just made it a point to publish the research results, whatever they were. Mm-hmm. And then the decisions as to who did what and what materials were used and so on was vested in the State Highway Commission, not Purdue University. It was a political arm of the state that made the final decision. But we did the research and published it and said, here are the facts. Now somebody else can determine how they're, whether they're going to be ignored or whether they're going to be used. We never took the position that because our research showed something that we then were going to force it down somebody's throat or somebody else's problem. And there are a great many kinds of research. You see, the two great materials that are used are asphalt and concrete. When you build a highway, which are you going to use?
And if so, how much? What percentage of aggregate and so on?
Well, I mean, what are you, concrete or asphalt? And of course, the people in the asphalt business want to sell asphalt. The people in the concrete business want to sell concrete. And how do you decide for any given road which kind of surface or which kind of materials you're going to use? What kind of road you're going to build?
Well, I think that's a very good example.
Well, the Agricultural Research Station, of course, publishes its results. Whether the individual farmer or the corporate farmer wants to use the results, apply the results, it's up to them. Yeah. Well, what were we talking about? Faculty relations?
Yes, we're talking about faculty. Well, this is still on it.
Well, yes.
Sure it is. Because what you've been talking really is the where the faculties can function best in a state school, or how it functions best.
You see, one of the miracles of the Indiana legislature in recent years was that despite all the worry of the older generation, Ray, the student, so-called student protest movement, both inactive and active, we never had any repressive legislation. Enacted by the State General Assembly.
To what do you attribute this?
Well, I attribute this to the good relationships that the four state institutions had with the General Assembly, and the fact that our reputation over the years had been, with respect to the management of our institutions, had been good enough so that in general the legislatures wouldn't pass silly repressive legislation. Made for a lot of interesting committee hearings, and many individuals tried to aggrandize their own stature before the conservative public by attacking the universities and attacking the young people. But nowadays the matter is the other way around, because the politicians are all wooing the young people.
Several million votes there.
Well, of course, but before they enfranchised the 18-year-olds, politicians weren't worried about the young. Although any self-respecting political party, in order to have a long life and to exist, ought to pay attention to the young. You see, the first thing a fascist dictatorship or a dictatorship of any kind does is go in and take control of the school system and organize the young. Mussolini did it, Hitler did it, communists did it.
Standard practice.
Standard practice, you see. And Mao did it with the young Chinese, and then he released them to demonstrate. And then Ed, the excesses became so bad he had to call it back. Well, many years ago was it that the young Red Guard, or whatever it was called, was raising Cain in communist China?
About 10 years ago.
No, it was a lot shorter than that, wasn't it? 6 years ago or so.
They had about 3 years, as I remember, or they...
Oh, well.
And, of course, Franco's done it in Spain.
Oh, yes, every dictator who takes over the school system, the university system, and then organizes the young people.
Have you ever had any pressure from any religious denomination or any show of public dissatisfaction from any religious denomination? We seem to have excellent relations here with 21 or 22 denominational centers around the campus.
Well, we've never had any difficulty with that, because we've never allowed religion to be part and parcel, any matter of religion to be part and parcel of the university determination, policy, complete non-partisan view with respect to religions. The only kind of thing you get is from individuals who individuals who are members of various religions objecting to, individual Jews object to invocation or what's the final religious ceremony? Benediction.
Benediction.
Jews always, some of them, very few, would object to a benediction in the name of Jesus Christ, you see. And then the Hindus and the Muslims and the other races, some of them, individuals, said that there shouldn't be a invocation or a convocation, invocation or benediction.
Or a celebration of Christmas at the Union, that sort of thing. Pageants.
Well, yeah, but those individuals, we never paid much attention to them, because the vast majority were happy with the way that these things were handled at the university.
Oh, yes.
The selection of commencement invocation speakers was rotated around among all the major faiths.
Local clergymen.
Local clergymen, and sooner or later they all got their turn at it. Then with respect to all the student churches and religious organizations, my policy was strictly hands off.
What of the time when there was some objection that Notre Dame, by establishing courses for credit here, might be coming on the campus? That was resolved satisfactorily, I know. But.
Well, it depends on your view whether it was resolved satisfactorily. As far as I was concerned, if somebody wanted to come over here and teach philosophy, Notre Dame wanted to be a part of it, and it was philosophy taught with a bias or not, and a student wanted to take it, well, it was fine with me. Any student who wants to study any course is fine. It's fine with me. The university has no right per se to say he can't do it. The university might have a right to refuse to give credit to courses taught elsewhere, which it does exercise. But if the course were approved by Notre Dame, we accepted other Notre Dame courses, then presumably we should accept.
Couldn't very well stop this, could you?
Of course, the people who objected, of course, were the people who taught philosophy at Purdue University. And person wanted to take a particular course in religious philosophy from a Catholic philosopher, it's fine. isn't going to hurt him. Might add to his knowledge. And of course, the Lutherans have to come in with the same kind of a program.
Well, naturally.
If they wanted to do that, it was fine with me. No objection whatsoever.
Have any other religious group done that, besides the Lutheran and the Catholics?
Not that I know of. I don't know if there's another religion with a large enough body of constituents to warrant such a thing. But of course, all the religious groups have their own programs, their own study programs, their own Bible programs, their own adult education programs, which they administer themselves and which people go to of their own free will.
I've always thought it was a very happy relationship, that that there really has been no problem, and those who wish to go to campus religious groups would find excellent service and apparently a very efficient administering to their needs.
Well, regardless of what your own attitude may be personally, I suppose 80% of the freshman boys and girls coming into this university, maybe more, maybe 90%, belong to one of the Christian denominations, are raised in families that belong to churches, have gone to Sunday school. Their interest in their religion varies from intense on the one end to almost none on the other. But it's still a force in their lives. When I brought the first philosopher to this campus, I chose a religious philosopher, because the one common kind of philosophy that more people wanted to study than any other kind for their general education was religious philosophy.
And you brought an excellent man just for that purpose, and he's done a beautiful job.
And I brought Dave and
Eric Clitheroe.
Eric Clitheroe, who was a great teacher and had been ordained, actually, in the Presbyterian ministry, I think. He was trained in Scotland, wasn't he?
Part of his
training.
Yes, he has his doctor's degree from the University of Edinburgh.
Well, Eric Clitheroe was the first philosopher. And interest in philosophical courses at Purdue grew from the day he came until now. Our philosophy department must have 14, 15 people in it.
And is a good department. Excellent one.
We've got some fine people.
I bet you have.
But, and as a matter of fact, the Notre Dame philosophy course is over at St. Thomas Aquinas. The first man who taught that course here is now president of one of the leading Catholic colleges and universities.
See, he went to Providence College.
Yeah, what was his name?
Bob, oh dear, don't ask me, I forgot.
I've forgotten him temporarily, too. But I knew him when he was on campus,
oh,
and
yes.
He was a very outstanding priest.
Yes, he was. And a good philosopher, excellent.
Well, I don't know much about his attainments in the field of philosophy, but he was a fine person.
I've checked up on his reputation because of another connection I have. I've got to know who some of these people are and how well they're thought of. We've had good men.
Now, the Catholic Church's attitude towards the education of the children of members of the Catholic Church is a special kind of policy attitude on the part of that particular denomination. And that's why the Catholic religion is the only religion that has been able to and has earned the right to have Catholic schools, because they've supported them. It was open to all the other religions too, but they
chose not to.
The Lutherans supported a lot of schools. The Methodists had a fine school record in establishment of colleges. The Baptists, and of course the Mormons are tremendous supporters of education within their structure. The Utah, for many years, was the state in which the highest percentage of college, high school graduates went on to college. Something close to 90% of high school graduates in Utah go on to college. In Indiana, for many years, it was around 35 to 38%. And I once asked the Secretary of Agriculture, who was a great Mormon.
I can say Claude Wickard, but that is...
No, Claude Wickard was our own graduate, but... what was his name?
It was under Eisenhower.
Yes. Vasquita.
My memory is bad.
He was the Secretary of Agriculture. The name was a Mormon.
Benson, of course.
Benson, sure. No one's asked Ezra Benson. Question. I said, why is it that in Utah you lead the nation in high school graduates going on to college? He thought for a moment. Well, he didn't know that fact, but so it might go back to the Mormon Youth Organization, which is a youth organization that is for the Mormons, a combination of the Boy Scouts, the Girl Scouts, the YMCA, the YWCA, the 4-H, Future Farmers of America, the whole shooting match of youth organizations. And he said the motto of that youth organization of ours is, intelligence is the glory of God. I said, well, that's as good an explanation as I could have. In the world, we've never had enough education. No nation, no people, not even ours. And if there be any fruit to science and technology, it's the fruit of leisure and remission of labor for a people. Now, as science and technology and productivity increase, produce all the things people want. You need a smaller and smaller labor force to do this as you multiply man's productivity with energy and machines. So then you are faced with taking people off the labor market. And you take them off at both ends of the age scale. You take them off at the young age and you take them off at the old age. You retire people earlier and you start them later. Well, nowadays, nobody wants to hire a high school graduate, too young, 2018, hasn't learned anything yet, learned how to do anything. And so the high school graduate goes on to college, junior college, community college, or the armed forces. And then he begins to enter the labor market at 21 to 22. 23 or 24. And so a man's working life is cut down, and this is one of the fruits of... Now, what do you do with the people that retire early in your society, who are given the leisure and surcease from work? You have to provide them enough so they can live. They have to be able to earn enough during their working lifetime to carry them through to their death, which is done by society via Social Security, and that's the genesis of Social Security, because there's only one man out of 100 that can lay by enough of the world's capital to guarantee a security. And no one can guarantee a security against illness, or cancer, or mental disease, or any of the frailties of the human biological structure. So, struck the number of people, high school graduates going on to colleges and universities now, or post-high school educational training of one kind or another, is about 50% in the nation. Of course, all major industries and large industries for new employees at the lowest levels have training programs, educational programs. Labor unions sponsor apprentice programs. And through the apprentice programs, they control the entry to the unions. I mean, how many plumbers and how many bricklayers and how many this, that, and the other in the craft unions are going to be allowed to work is determined by the unions, essentially, by the number of apprentices they permit. And the race and creed and color of the apprentices. There are quite a few unions that don't have many Negro members.
Well, certainly they're competitive with white members.
Well, there haven't been many Negroes, so the white members control the union.
Sure.
I mean, the reasons why all these things are true are there and can be looked at. They're obvious. The point of contention between university administration and trustees on the one hand and faculty organizing on the other is the degree and the power, the degree to which the faculty organization is given powers or exercises powers. Many of the faculty would like to have the faculty have all the presidential powers. Now, how would the faculty go about allocating the resources of the university between competing faculties?
Simple, let my outfit get all that it needs first and you can have the rest.
Right, right. Then when the vote is taken, who wins?
Right.
And who's satisfied with the vote, which is 51 to 49? 51 faculty members vote for engineering and 49 vote for humanities.
Obviously unfair if I'm in humanities school.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Give us enough so we can get 52 against 51 engineers, and then we're set. Then we'll vote.
It used to be said that some universities, such a University of Wisconsin, the Senate actually controlled the administration. Now, I don't know whether that is true or not. Do you know of any university in which a faculty senate or a faculty group can, in the, just as we've been talking, control the appropriations? I've never heard of one.
Oh, you mean control the allocation
yes.
of what the appropriations
yes.
may be. First place, the universities can't control the appropriations because they come from the legislature. And of course, you never get what you ask for, or never get enough.
That's true.
Depending on your viewpoint in the matter.
I've never found an educator yet who had quite enough money to do what he wanted to do. Never, have you?
And of course, for all the leaders and the bright ones in the faculty who have really ongoing programs of great merit, there never is enough money. But in the grand scheme of things, you have to bring the whole along. You can't allow one part of the institution to dominate the whole institution.
I think one of the most excellent arrangements I've seen is the way in which, at Purdue at least, the athletic department supports itself, has supported itself largely through its own autonomous program. There's not a great deal of allocation for the athletics, is there?
None.
Well, that, I mean, that is, I understand, rather exceptional.
Well, no, not entirely exceptional because a great many of the Big Ten universities, the state universities in the Big Ten, unless they're in very bad difficulty, have to subsidize their athletic program because the football program is brought in enough to substitute the intercollegiate athletic program. The extent and magnitude of your intramural athletic program for all the students is enough horse of another color. We've been very lucky here because we have the play fields and we've invested in the intramural gymnasium. And the whole student body pays for this out of their athletic fee.
We've got a good program.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any question.
We have the best intramural program in the Big Ten, the highest.
I don't think
the highest percentage of student participation.
No question.
In the collegiate program has always been very, very well managed, self-supporting, and has essentially built our facilities for intercollegiate athletics and some of the facilities for the intramural program and the club sports program. But how do you get a lot of money to support a rowing program?
We don't
have enough. Who provides it? Where does it come from? Where could it come from? Any place?
Well,
you couldn't sell it to the state.
Oh, no, but you sell it to the alumni. You have enough
alumni.
Well,
you sell it to those who are interested in it.
That is correct.
And those few people who are interested in it will put up a little money and so on to help.
And
the participants pay for it. It's like playing golf. If you want to play golf, you buy your own clubs and your own balls.
That's right.
You go out and pay the greens fee at a public course. Otherwise, you don't play golf. Well, the total state appropriation annually by law must go to the academic and research program of the university. And that part which supports the research program is earmarked. The Agricultural Research Station, state appropriations earmarked for agricultural research. We must put the money there by law. But the rest of the general state appropriation doesn't even pay the faculty salary budget because we have other sources of income. We have all the student fees that go in the general fund.
Yeah.
And so every dollar of the state appropriation essentially goes to the teaching core of Purdue University.
What percentage of the student funds, does a student pay for his education as compared to what he used to pay?
Oh, that percentage hasn't varied very much.
Around 30%?
Oh, no, no. The general rule in colleges and universities is that the student fees represent about 20% in the state institutions, and they represent 40% in the private institutions. And we won't vary very much from those around 20% as a state institution. Only varies a few percentage points, or one plus or minus 20.
And then if the state legislature reduces appropriations and you wish to keep up the quality of service, the student fees have to increase.
Or you have to get money from some other source. You get federal money, or you have to get private money, gift money. Or if you have a football team like Notre Dame's, maybe you can get $1 million a year out of football.
Which will go to build laboratories and...
Which might be used in the academic program. But there's only one Notre Dame.
Well, no, on that one, I don't want to answer that. Should I say thank God or just say what a wonderful example or what?
No.
Just one Notre Dame, you're quite right. Well, we've talked about the faculty. Is there anything more we ought to say about the faculty? Except one thing that...
The measure of the reputation of a university depends on its faculty.
Certainly.
And the problem here occasionally you go out to hunt for a particular kind of faculty member in a particular field or professional area, discipline. But in general, your principal hirees, principal new people in the teaching core of the university are always the young assistant professors. And here you'll hire five, and if one turns out to be a star, your batting average is pretty good.
It's very good.
And so the department head, who pays a lot of attention to the quality of the young guys he hires, is the guy who in 10 years' time begins to have his head above water in the academic competitive scene. Then the first thing you know, he has four or five bright young associate professors. Then other people come and steal several of them away from him. And you're left with one or two that are your own leaders.
That's the way it goes.
But, in my younger days at Minnesota, I knew President Kaufman very well. One of his great bête noirs was the fact that every time a bright young faculty member began to stick his head above the competitive waters, Harvard or one of the Ivy League schools would come along and steal him away.
Because
the same is true at Oxford and Cambridge in England, you see.
Of course.
I mean, Oxford and Cambridge can have anybody they want. Simply because it's the Acme. And so whenever there's a professorship vacant at Oxford or Cambridge, all the leading young professors in that discipline throughout the British Isles put their names in. No choice. Right?
The way it works, and then there's the other rule too, that on a faculty, a third-rate man can very seldom hire to work for him a first-rate man, very seldom. So you've got to have first-rate men in charge to do the hiring. I ran into example of that the other day and with the present head of biology, who was talking on this very point of the problem of getting excellence in the younger biology department and what they were doing to do it. And he seems to think we have been competitive and we get our share.
Well, we've been great in biology. They say the department's with great leadership that stays with you in a fairly short time after the department.
And that's the way to build a faculty.
That's right.
Of course, sometimes
you don't build a faculty on people who don't do anything. And who insist on their tenure and sitting on their tails. Not very good teachers, and they're not very good scholars, and they're not very good anything.
Very, very true. And of course, if your faculty is going to be good, it must have support from the school to offer money and to have facilities.
Well, you give them everything you can out of their what you determine to be a reasonable share in the allocation.
Of course.
Well, what you have always is the departments go through cycles. Good cycles and bad cycles and so on. And at any given time, any given budget, every given budget year, there are always a few departments that are in trouble. And so you take and give them a boost and a help above the ordinary. You can only do this for a few each year. And this way you help a few get up to the standard of the university. But if you took that same amount of money and divided it equally among all of the 50, 60 departments in the university, it wouldn't mean a thing.
Of course you couldn't. You couldn't do it.
It wouldn't mean a thing.
Then you have to determine your priorities and the job that you have to do. I always tell many of my young colleagues who come and complain about the lack of books in the history department, I said, remember that Purdue is the school, a land-grant college, and history was not one of its original missions. And then I point out, we've been going great guns in the last few years, but for a long time, you were not going to turn out PhDs in history. Just exactly right.
Very many fine institutions, public and private, both have been turning out PhDs in history from time immemorial.
That's right. It wasn't Purdue's job.
You're a historian, Bob.
Well, it wasn't Purdue's job.
It wasn't their job,
no.
Exactly.
No question. Well, sir, I've got to go and teach a class in history.
Right.
And let us resume this another occasion. Let us say this is the end of the seventh interview between President Emeritus Frederick L. Hubde and R.B. Eccles for the Purdue University Archives.
Right.